Okay, we're here to talk about ceasefire and just give you a little more information than you heard this morning. We normally spend a fair amount of time kind of doing this overview, but I'm going to breeze on through it because I really think that the meat of the program sits before you. It doesn't sit with me. I'm the chief operating officer. I'm the person kind of behind the scenes that makes sure that we have some structure to all this stuff. You heard about the evaluation report this morning. I'm going to ask Charlie to pick up at the end a little bit more about this. We really did have some pretty significant success in Chicago, at least in the neighborhoods where we were working. We were working in enough of them, we think, to see citywide results. And I would say we were added value to what law enforcement and other community groups were already doing. We're not a substitute for what the police are doing. We're not a substitute for what's already happening in the communities. We are really value added to their work. Our goal, as Gary said this morning, very simple. We're about stopping shootings and killings, not an anti-gang program, not an anti-drug program, not an anti-gun program. We work with the people that are most closely associated with the problem in the areas where they are that are disproportionately affected. So we really look at those hot spots. You saw the picture this morning of the city and that the problem is concentrated largely on the south and west sides. We work within the hot spots that are even within those areas. And actually, we're only working right now in about 25% of the neighborhoods that we think we should be in. So we're very data and research driven, very much guided in our work by what others have done before us and an analysis of the current data. Gary talked a little bit this morning, actually he talked a lot, about the violence being a learned behavior that's reinforced by norms. So I'm not going to go through that. Critical elements of ceasefire. This is where the program really hits the ground. And if you want to say that you're doing ceasefire in sort of Chicago style, then you need to have the right participants. You need to be working with the people that are most closely associated with the problem. I'm going to come back to that in a minute. We also have, you know, data that we can share for folks that are interested. It talks a little bit more about who we actually are working with. We need to work in the right community. We need to work where the problem is most acute. So we really have been selective. There are parts of Chicago, quite a few, where the violence problem isn't very high.
You should be shocked.
That, you know, any of us would be happy to live and feel very safe walking at night, you know, using the usual cautions one would use in any community. But, you know, certainly it's not an equally distributed problem throughout the city. We have certain neighborhoods that are very high risk, and we have others that are very low risk. We don't work in the low risk areas. We have to have the right partners. We found over time that that means we have to have an organization that has a mission that's similar to ours, that is trying to stop violence, that's interested in reducing shootings and killings, a group that can manage the population that we're looking to hire to be the workers, as well as committed to the population that we're trying to engage, and that are willing to do, for our purposes, all the data collection and documentation that we really require in order to figure out if we're making a kind of impact that we want. Now, we have some other criteria about their ability to manage money and things like that, because we actually get money from the state that we pass through to local community partners, so accountability becomes a big issue for us. Right workers with the right skills, we're going to talk a lot more about that. The approach, we're going to talk a lot more about that. Relationship with law enforcement, as I said, we kind of have this push-pull relationship with law enforcement. They give us data. They give us official data. Every 3 months, we get actual data from the police department that we map and that we manipulate and we use to kind of get a better handle on what's going on in our areas as well as parts of the city that we're not active in. They sit on our hiring panels. They participate, you know, side by side with us in selecting the staff that are going to be out there in the field. They conduct background checks for us, which we actually ask them to do on a regular basis. It isn't just when someone's hired, but every 6 months we ask that names be run through the department because we're putting workers out in harm's way. We want to make sure that they actually are doing the kinds of things that we want them to do and not putting themselves, the program, or others at risk, not necessarily in that order, themselves at risk for sure. And then, you know, we get, perhaps when we started out, this was the most critical piece, we get daily notification of shootings that happened the night before or the day before. So we have an immediate notification from the police department as to what was happening. We are also now, at least on the south side, getting information from our hospital partner there. We respond to any shooting trauma, blunt trauma, or stabbing victim who's brought to Christ Advocate Hospital. So we get immediate information, notification And last year, that was over 600 folks who were brought to the emergency department that we responded to in person within 30 to 60 minutes. So we got really good information about what was going on. They could be fed right back into the field immediately. But before we had that relationship established, we really were relying on police. And then over time, the contacts that were developed by our outreach staff and our interrupters, because they actually then are getting information probably about the same time that law enforcement are getting it. So it's not as critical now, but it's still really important to maintain the relationship. The right messages and messengers. You heard Gary talk this morning about credibility. You know, credible messengers, credible messengers, credible messengers. We can't emphasize that enough. And it's not just that these folks are credible messengers with the people that they're working with in the field. It's people at the community level, people at the city level. So we really have to address multiple audiences simultaneously in order to push out the messages regarding individual change and norm change that lead to change at the community level. And then measures of effectiveness and accountability. And I would ask Tim if you'll talk just a minute or two about the kind of data that we collect from sure. our community partners.
I would say, obviously, a program like this has a myriad of problems in terms of collecting data, and I've been with the program for 7 years, and the way that we collect data has changed multiple times over that time. We have had a lot of input from our community partners, and specifically from street staff in terms of things that they're willing to document on a piece of paper that doesn't incriminate the people they're working with. So there's been a lot of sort of working through, you know, the language we use when we're talking, when we're trying to document what people are doing without documenting incriminating situations. At this point, we have a web-based data system that collects data from our community partners, from outreach workers, and from the violence interrupters in terms of the work that they do. And some of that includes responses to shootings, the number of people that go to those, other activities that we have in the communities, the number of partners and meetings that our community agencies attend. Public education materials distributed. And then in terms of outreach, we have the number of participants, the referrals that are made, sort of hours spent with them, their change over time in terms of what their status was for employment and education and substance abuse issues. And then in terms of conflict mediations, which is what the violence interrupters do specifically and what outreach workers do as well, we've created a system where we document sort of the primary reasons for conflicts and the risk factors behind those conflicts, and then what was done about it and the outcomes. And it's, you know, this has been a difficult task to document all this work, but I think between lots of people working together to try to figure out the best way to do it, I'm more comfortable now than I have ever been about the way that we're documenting things.
There. Thanks, Tim. I mean, one of the big things about this is, you know, Tim said, well, we're doing more now, we're more confident now. A lot of growth has taken place since we actually implemented the full program in Ceasefire West, which was the West Garfield, West Humboldt Park area, 11 or so years ago. You know, we've learned and we've incorporated those lessons learned into our daily work, which, really goes directly to the data collection as well. And there's been an enormous amount of training. You know, we were doing some ad hoc training, doing a lot of things collected by paper. Now we have, you know, the fully automated system, which means that we have another challenge presented because we're trying to get our line staff, our field staff, to do things electronically, and they're not always comfortable with that. So we just tell them we're building their skills. You know, we're preparing them for the next job. You know, it's a staff development opportunity. And they look at us like, yeah, right, you know. It just means you don't want to do the data entry. But it's not just that. It means that we can have more timely feedback to them because we meet monthly with the sites and give them the feedback, the information, the data that they've given us, we feed back to them. So it's important for them to be able to use it as a management tool and as course correction. Are they working with the right people? That kind of stuff. Because we have four criteria for someone who's high risk. Four out of seven have to be met. Here we go. Okay, we're going to talk now at more length about the approach. This is what we actually do on the ground. And we have five core components. As I said, and I can't really stress enough, we are really looking to work with the people who are most likely to shoot someone else or be shot themselves. Well, how do we find them? I'll let these guys talk about how we find them. But we're really looking for people who will be in harm's way. So what kinds of criteria would that mean? Well, between 16 and 25 for the most part. Will we take someone who's younger or older? Absolutely, but they have to meet at least four of the other criteria. Someone who's the recent victim of a shooting. Research tells us if you were involved in a shooting, there's a great likelihood that you're going to be involved again in a very short time horizon. And in fact, our work at Advocate, that's the reason that we're there. The trauma docs got tired of patching up the same people over and over, or subsequently hearing that someone had been killed, that they had, you know, they saved their lives 2 weeks ago, and now they were going to a funeral. Someone who's involved in high-risk activity, mostly that means dealing drugs or gang involvement, weapons carrying, someone who has been actively involved in one or more violent gangs in the city. You know, so we have set criteria that have to be applied. Will we take someone who has three of those seven? Yes, but then there's going to be questions asked, like, why did you really think that this person was going to be at high risk in the very near term? So about, I'd say, at this point, at least 85-90% of the clients that we're working with meet the high-risk criteria. And that really only happened. We only got to that high a level when we had implemented the criteria, but then we're feeding back to our partners and our field staff. You know, looks like you're really not working with a really high-risk group. So, you know, another use of the data. And I want to stress, while we only have a couple of representatives... Who's that good-looking guy on the right there? I'll be going
where,
to that.
Where?
I'll be going to that good-looking guy on the right in just a minute. But I want to stress that, you know, we're really talking about not just outreach workers, not just interrupters, because a lot of the media attention on the program, if you've seen some of that, has really focused on the work of the interrupters. They're part of a team. They're part of a team that includes, you know, folks that are responsible for community mobilization, overall direction of the staff, sometimes canvassers, people who go door-to-door to bring the message of the program, recruit community members to work with us, you know, who are actually, and this happens to be the Baltimore team that Frank was there training that day. So we have a sister program called Safe Streets in Baltimore whose early data an evaluation being done by Johns Hopkins is very promising. They've only have 1 year of data, so we really can't say, you know, unequivocally that it's had an effect. But